You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Even without a presidential election at the top of the ticket, political ad spending nationwide could reach somewhere up to around $10 billion, according to projections from the ad tracker Ad Impact Politics. By the end of July, Ad Impact said the cycle was already ahead of the historically expensive 2020 election cycle by $700 million in non-presidential ad spending. Wisconsin is front and center. The company ranks our governor's race as the most expensive general election in the country, our Senate race the fifth most expensive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about all the money going into campaigns and then into ads? Where are you running into political ads? Can you escape them? Do you think they make a difference? Do you see them influencing you or people you know? Do you think they're a waste of money? Or are you just plumb sick of them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes in the laws when it comes to political donations, too? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Christina LaPlante is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. She focuses on American politics and political behavior, plus campaign ads and public opinion. Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What is your reaction to this? We're seeing maybe a record-setting midterm election year when it comes to political ads.
Well, you know, I think we are very much on the trajectory of seeing records going to be shattered every single election. You know, ads just continue to play an even more and more powerful role each election cycle. And, you know, quite frankly, those take up the majority of the budgets for most campaigns. So not really surprising to me much at all.
Now, on the supply side, the money supply side, a couple of big Supreme Court decisions, U.S. Supreme Court, McCutcheon and Citizens United, they really loosen up the regulations, right? Do you see that being part of what's bringing more money into the system?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, when you look at the relatively loose standards of who can contribute to campaigns and the amount of money that people can contribute to campaigns, I still think that there's a long way to go in terms of having some, you know, meaningful reform, really cracking down on the, you know, role that money plays in American campaigns. And, you know, when you look at public opinion on this topic, there's an appetite for major scale reform here. People are aware of how much money is being invested into our elections to try to influence public opinion and how we think about candidates. So I think that there's still a long way to go and that there's public appetite for that.
The Supreme Court has said, though, in effect, if I hand a candidate money to run a campaign ad, that's political speech. It seems like it's hard to make any kind of changes. Or do you see room for reform, even given those past rulings?
That's a great question. I mean, really, just on this topic of the extent to which, you know, as a country and as a society, you know, that we are comfortable and willing with this precedent that's being set by the courts that spending money equals free speech. When we're talking about capital like that, where some people inherently have more of that capital than others, by virtue of those type of court precedents, we're saying that some people have more fundamental rights than others on this basis of capital and wealth and money. So I think that there's some problematic issues there that the, you know, certainly Americans need to consider the extent to which, you know, we're okay with the type of precedent that that sets.
All right, now let's get into ads. A lot of people, I think, are locked in. They're going to vote for a D or an R on the ballot. And I think if I ask anybody face to face, hey, do political ads sway you? I think most people would say, of course not. I'm not a sucker. They're not going to move me. Yet I'm guessing they must do something or people wouldn't keep spending money on them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a great question. You know, even in the discipline of political science, there's a lot of debate over the extent to which we believe that political ads influence voters. You've got one camp of academics that say, you know, listen, let's look at how polarized the country is. You know, we know that people are more than ever consistently voting for one party or another. They have got their vote locked in well before the election. Ads don't persuade. They don't change candidate favorability. What's the point? It's just a waste of money. But on the other hand, when we look at the research that political psychologists are doing, for example, we know that ads uniquely produce profound emotional reactions. Campaign ads uniquely scare us. They make us angry. And these emotional reactions, have a huge impact on our behaviors. When we're angry, we're more likely to engage in externalized behavior. We want to express that emotion. Sometimes we want to punch things, or sometimes it makes us want to go out and vote. So when I think we really have to consider that emotional reaction, and that drives, I think, by a large amount, our willingness to turn out and vote.
Now, if you and I were running for office against each other, my ads might not say, you know, a Christina LaPlante voter is going to switch to a Rob Ferret voter. But maybe I'm hoping that they'll discourage that Christina LaPlante voter enough. They raise enough doubt that they just don't show up at the polls that day. Is that a possibility?
I think it really is a turnout game. You know, the extent to which an ad is going to persuade someone who's been a lifelong Republican or Democrat voter to switch their vote, it certainly happens. But I think the biggest thing that we need to focus on is the extent to which these messages drive people out to vote in the first place, the extent to which these messages are activating and mobilizing people. So I think if you don't have a message that's striking people, giving them a reason to turn out and vote, and that's where you're going to lose the election.
Talking to Christina LaPlante, not my political opponent, but in fact an assistant professor at the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse, looking at big money in the midterm elections this year. Big money equals lots of ads. You may be seeing them. Join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you're seeing. How it makes you feel. Call 800-642-1234. Rick joins us now in Rhinelander. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, actually, you stole my thunder. I'd like to reiterate. No, that's okay. You'd like to reiterate that, unfortunately, fear and hate are great motivators, and the people who put forth those ads know that. Quite frankly, we can see that with the Ron Johnson ads currently being run against Mandela Barnes. They have echoes of Willie Horton ads that were done in the past in presidential elections, and I find it discouraging. The other thing is that elections have consequences, and who we have on the Supreme Court has consequences, and this is a good example. That Citizens United ruling that essentially eviscerated McCain-Feingold, which was an attempt to stop this dark money, has had a profound effect on these ads and on our politics. And I think everyone should be aware that every election, and particularly every presidential election, as it affects the Supreme Court, does have an effect on all of us, and we should all be aware of that.
Rick, thanks for the call. A couple of big points there, Christina. Let's start with this first point. Rick, concerned about fear and scare tactics in ads.
I could not have said those points better myself. Absolutely. We know in political psychology, it is these fear and anger-based messages that stick with us far much more than positive messaging. And that's one thing that I see coming out of the Barnes campaign a lot more than the Johnson campaign, is this attempt to have these promotional, hopeful, positive advertisements, learning about the candidate, you know, who I am as a person, what are my values? And, you know, that's great. And we need to hear that type of information. But, you know, research shows us that it's those negative messages that elicit fear and anger. Those are the ones that are sticking with us and that are informing our decisions on election day.
And then Rick's other point was the importance of the Supreme Court. Now, elections for senators, U.S. senators, they're the ones who confirm or decline to confirm Supreme Court appointees. This seems like it comes up as a bigger issue for presidential elections because the president nominates them. Do you see it as a driving issue, Christina, in an election for a Senate seat?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's an increasing phenomenon in American politics and elections known as this idea of the nationalization of elections. So, you know, when Wisconsin voters are going to vote for, you know, cast a vote between Ron Johnson or Mandela Barnes, it doesn't just have stakes for what's going on in Wisconsin and Wisconsin politics. There's national stakes here. And, you know, we're seeing increasingly election after election, voters and donors from other states are increasingly giving to races happening in states that they don't reside in. And the stakes are high. And when you juxtapose this with the incredible amount of divisiveness that we have in American politics, you know, you've got politicians who are running on essentially national campaigns, and the stakes are higher than ever. And the Supreme Court is a major function and feature of the campaign advertisements and messages that we see.
Thanks for that call, Rick. We're talking about big spending on political ads in the 2022 midterm elections, especially here in Wisconsin. Christina LaPlante is our guest, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW La Crosse. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about political ads? Do you feel like they're all you're seeing when you watch, say, a streaming TV show or a YouTube video or broadcast a TV show or sporting event? Have things changed? Are you finding them disillusioning? Do you want to see changes in the way campaigns are financed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about big spending on political ads this year. Christina LaPlante is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW La Crosse. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your observations, if you're seeing lots of ads or taking careful measures to avoid them, your thoughts on how we pay for political campaigns in this country. Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mitchell is with us in North America. I guess we didn't narrow that down. Mitchell, hi.
Hi. Hi, Rob. Hi, Christina. Thanks for having me on. I'm actually in Wisconsin.
Okay.
Up by Superior. And I just wanted to say that I think that a reform of the political ads and how we deal with them would be great. If we could somehow equalize all of the airtime and maybe use tax revenues to give equal opportunity to each of the candidates in all of the races, that would be, I think, a decent idea in my mind.
Interesting.
And I don't know if that would necessarily change anything, but keep at least the parameters for the advertisements to only how they feel on the issues.
Mitchell, thanks for that call. Now, Christina, I know some states and communities have experimented with public financing, court challenges there. I know some countries, Israel leaps to mind, where there is that sort of, we're going to give all the candidates X amount of equal time on broadcast. At least it used to be that way. What do you think of those ideas Mitchell brought up?
Beautiful points, first of all. And, you know, we've experimented with this in American politics, equal time and, creating standards for major media networks to, give everyone a fair shot to have an opportunity to express, their viewpoints, their campaigns, be heard by the American voters. But there's a lot more things that we could do, I think, on a bigger scale that other countries are doing. In fact, the United States is a minority when we look at the way that ads are regulated. Most democracies have vast amounts of regulations on what you can say in your advertisements, for instance, having rules about, your ads need to predominantly focus on policy, not, baseless mudslinging attacks on your opponent. So, there's lots of things that can be done. And we see that being done quite well in other countries. But again, you mentioned the, First Amendment kind of at the beginning here. And I think that that's the major obstacle, chipping away at those First Amendment rights. And, how do we walk this tightrope of, holding politicians accountable, having government regulations on the content of politicians' messaging, and balancing that all with the First Amendment, which is so coveted in our society.
Mitchell, thanks for that call. Catherine joins us next in Random Lake. Catherine, hi.
Hi. First off, I don't have a television, so happily my blood pressure stays low this time of the year. And then along with that, freedom of speech should not cover lies and half-truths. And I think before these ads go on the air, they should have to pass through some sort of mustard that says they're truthful ads. Maybe then we would get a few more ads that talk about policy instead of just slinging mud.
Catherine, thanks a lot for that call. Christina, my understanding of the state of regulation or non-regulation of ads is, like, I could literally say in a campaign ad, my opponent is a literal non-metaphorical werewolf. I can say anything I want, right? And there's no real check on that because of the political speech element here.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the bottom line here is that what we say in campaign advertisements are just fundamentally unregulated. And I see, you know, people reacting to that. And you look at public opinion polls, and it's remarkable that, you know, most Americans, I don't have the figure right off the top of my head, but quite a significant number of Americans don't believe what they see in campaign advertisements. As some of the callers have alluded to already, we're sick and tired of the negative discourse that emanates from all of the negative attack advertisements, and people are fed up. But nonetheless, we continue to see this be a major cornerstone of American campaigns. And it really just boils down, I think, to effective leadership and ethics and reintroducing that into the political narrative and holding our politicians accountable. And, you know, there is some, I think, responsibility on behalf of the voters, at least, to say, you know, we're tired of this messaging and we're going to hold you accountable.
The tricky thing there, though, is if my candidate's doing it and their candidate's doing the same thing, I can't hold them both accountable. So I'll just end up voting for my candidate and maybe hold my nose if I didn't like their dirty ads.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this requires systemic shifts happening all throughout American politics. And you're right. You know, if your opponent is going negative and you take the high road, like we said earlier, you know, those messages aren't going to stick with voters. You're not energizing or exciting people or scaring them into voting. So, I mean, in many ways, it is a catch-22.
We're talking to Christina LaPlante from UW La Crosse, looking at big money in American politics and Wisconsin politics, for that matter, and lots of campaign ads. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us now in Northern Illinois. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? Great to hear your voice.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Paul?
I think it's really aligned with everything that we're talking about. I guess the thing here is, since we know that our governance is really a capitalist function and we want money to run it because we elected to do so, how could we, since the average citizen agrees with everything we're saying here, doesn't want money in politics? We want governance of our country, not fundraising, because that's what we spend most of our time doing. How do we get Congress to govern themselves like in so many other fashions, rather than just say, well, it's my vote, since I don't have anyone to vote for who's not playing the game?
Paul, thanks for the call. What do you think, Christina?
I mean, it's absolutely a huge hurdle. You know, we've spent so much time talking about, you know, big money, big interest, really dictating the rules of the game, who runs for office, the law of the land. I mean, there are huge obstacles here. And you know, there have been some pretty progressive proposals, you know, maybe ballot initiatives across, you know, the 50 states. And let's get a constitutional amendment about, you know, regulating campaigns, regulating elections, and, you know, making it more fair and kind of putting that power back into the hands of the people. Lots of different ways of achieving this. But again, it's going to require a massive kind of groundswell grassroots movement to, I think, unfortunately, really change things and combat these ultra wealthy special interests that have grown to dominate much of American politics.
Thanks for that call. All right, I got a big question, Christina, and I'm guessing there's a lively debate on this. Are political ads, especially the negative ads, I guess, bad in some way for our system of represented government?
Well, I mean, we can use negative advertisements to certainly hold politicians accountable, to educate voters about you know, any number of things, you know, questionable personal, professional background, things that, you know, voters are entitled to know. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that, you know, these negative advertisements, the negativity that's kind of inherent in our society and our politics, you look at public opinion data that people are increasingly cutting off family members because they don't share their same ideological positions, or they don't vote for the same candidates. You know, we're not hanging out with people who have different partisan allegiances than we do. And that's a big problem. And that is, you know, one of the primary factors that divides us and keeps us divided. So, I mean, I think you could certainly argue that there's a time and place for negative advertisements. But, you know, when you're looking at the breakdown at the end of an election, 80 to 90% of the ad content was, you know, baseless, negative, fear-mongering attacks on your opponent. I mean, I think we need to put those two things into perspective there.
I want to take our last minute, Christina. Can you sit down with a voter here and say, okay, here's how to cut through the noise and the negativity and, you know, make an informed decision about which candidate to support in an election? What kind of advice would you give?
I'm so glad that you asked that. That's actually something that I talk with my students a lot about quite a lot. I'm actually teaching a course on campaigns and elections right now, and we are getting ready to analyze campaign messages and strategies and advertisements. And before we begin that content, I sit with them and I tell you, you know, I want you to pay attention to the messages that you receive from candidates, the messages that you hear from politicians. And I want you to kind of sit with that reaction after you hear any type of communications from a politician and ask yourself, what is this communication trying to make me feel? Is it trying to make me feel angry? If so, at what? Is it trying to make me feel afraid? If so, at whom? And sit with those feelings and think about what the motivation underlying that communication must be. And having an awareness of when our emotions are trying to be manipulated, and having the resources we need to identify that and not be so vulnerable to the emotions that are elicited in these messages.
Christina, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Christina LaPlante, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. We talked to her today about big money being spent on the midterm elections, including one tracker's ranking of the races for governor and senator in Wisconsin among the top spending in the country. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Temple Grandin joins the show for a look inside the minds of people who think in pictures instead of words and her new book, Visual Thinking. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, two chronic fatigue experts join us to talk about what that condition tells us about long COVID. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. If you have a sweet tooth, listen in, because our next guest can help us sweeten our baked goods with fruits and other foods without adding sugar. First, chronic fatigue syndrome is a debilitating condition that has a history of being disbelieved or ignored by a lot of the medical community. Also known as myalgic encephalomyelitis, or MECFS, it's gotten some attention from specialized researchers and doctors over the years. Now, the few doctors who do treat the condition are in the limelight because it looks a lot like long COVID. We're talking about the connections between chronic fatigue syndrome, or MECFS, and long COVID. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had chronic fatigue syndrome yourself in the past? Are you dealing with long COVID now? Can you share your experiences, your quest maybe to find treatment? What questions do you have for our guests about these conditions? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jamie Seltzer is Director of Scientific and Medical Outreach for ME Action and a researcher who studies post-exertional malaise with Stanford University. She's also living with ME-CFS. Jamie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And Dr. David Kaufman is an internal medicine physician at the Center for Complex Diseases, which he co-founded. He's former medical director of the Open Medicine Institute. He specializes in chronic infections, MECFS, and other chronic complex illnesses. Dr. Kaufman, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Jamie, I want to start with you. You're in a unique position. You research this. You do outreach on it. You're also experiencing it yourself. Can you give us a sense of what life is like with this chronic fatigue, this MECFS?
Well, I think that it differs person to person, but just to give you more of the average picture of what the disease is like, 25% of people with this disease are housebound or bedbound, and the quality of life is on average lower than that to of any other disease to which I'm aware it has been compared, including things like multiple sclerosis, chronic renal failure, many different kinds of cancer. And the reason that that quality of life is so low in comparison to other serious diseases may well be because there are no FDA-approved medications, clinical education is scant, and a lot of people don't get a diagnosis or any kind of intervention or treatment for a very long time. I think that the fact that this disease often has onset in the teens and the early 30s means that for the latter group, people are just beginning their work life, their professional life. Maybe they've just gotten married, just had children, and their ability to do their usual activities disappears overnight. And it can feel like they've lost their old life and they don't know what to do.
And Dr. Kaufman, you've treated a lot of people with ME/CFS, and I understand you're working with long COVID patients now as well. What goes into diagnosing this chronic fatigue, this ME/CFS?
So first, I think Jamie gave a really great summary of the problem and the situation. So you know, the first thing I would say in terms of diagnosis is taking a very careful, comprehensive history. So many of the patients that I see have been sick for 5 to 25 years. They've been to 5 to 50 physicians, mostly just told that they have fatigue or that they're anxious or they're depressed. But if you sit down and you take a careful, comprehensive history, which can take a good hour to 2 hours, and that's part of the problem, you learn a lot. And what I do is look for the parameters, the criteria that define ME/CFS based on the Institute of Medicine work in 2015. But way more than that, look for the underlying causes, which I believe relate to the presentation or the phenotype of ME/CFS.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit, Dr. Kaufman, about the causes of chronic fatigue syndrome?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me start out by saying I don't think anybody actually understands the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome. We have lots of ideas. It has been a mysterious and hugely challenging question. There is no specific biomarker. You can't do a culture for strep and say that means they have CFS. You can't do a blood test and get something that defines ME/CFS. So that said, to me, the underlying causes, about 2/3 of the time, it's patients present after having had a viral infection most often. It can also be a bacterial infection in the tick-borne diseases, or it can be mycoplasma or respiratory chlamydia. And but most commonly, it's a viral infection. In that sense, similar to what we'll get into later, which is related to long COVID. And that viral infection, and now we're getting into a little bit of theory or speculation, that viral infection looks to kick off, cause autoimmune responses and reactions in predisposed or vulnerable people, and that then leads to a whole sequence or series of pathologies that lead to the illness.
And Jamie, you work on specifically post-exertional malaise, a key symptom in both long COVID, as I understand it, and what we're talking about here, ME. Can you talk about this concept of post-exertional malaise?
Absolutely. So post-exertional malaise, or PEM, is a response to cognitive or physical exertion that is pathological. So previously tolerated cognitive or physical activity will induce, often after a characteristic delay, a cascade of symptoms. Some of these symptoms are the usual symptoms getting worse. Other ones may only appear during the post-exertional malaise. And it can be quite severe. And it's part of the reason that patients present so dramatically differently at one time or another. If they have overexerted, they may have trouble even sitting up in the morning, moving around, difficulty initiating movement. They may experience significantly worse neurological symptoms, sensory sensitivity. And it can be sincerely debilitating. Post-exertional malaise is considered the cardinal symptom of ME/CFS and is required in order to diagnose the disease. For patients who come into the clinic, clinicians should be listening for words like, I feel weighted down, I feel like gravity has increased, I feel like if I overdo it, I can't move, I can't think. Even though I think that some clinicians have struggled historically to identify the disease, I do truly think that if they sat down a patient and got them to explain their post-exertional malaise, they would never mistake ME/CFS for anything ever again that was not ME/CFS. And I would also say that there's an enormous overlap with the long COVID community. There are now a handful of small studies from ME/CFS literate researchers showing that about half of people who have the long COVID label also meet the diagnostic criteria for ME/CFS.
We were talking about myalgic encephalomyelitis, or ME, commonly called chronic fatigue syndrome. Put them together, ME/CFS is a common name. We have with us Jamie Seltzer with ME Action and Dr. David Kaufman with the Center for Complex Diseases. You can join in with your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Kaufman, let's pick up on Jamie's last point there. What are we seeing in long COVID that leads to so much overlap with what we had looked at as ME/CFS before?
Well, from my perspective, both reading about it, talking about it with other colleagues, and most importantly, seeing patients with long COVID, I'm going to go a step further than what the literature Jamie said. I would say pretty much every single long COVID patient I have met meets the criteria for ME/CFS. All the boxes are checked. Again, it comes down to the physician asking the right questions and listening to the answers. Understanding that when a patient says they have fatigue, you need to ask more questions about what that means. And as Jamie points out, you need to get into some details. Is the fatigue after you climb the stairs, or is it the next day, et cetera, et cetera? And if you ask those questions with long COVID patients, you start seeing the same answers. Almost all the ME/CFS patients I see at one point or another have autonomic nervous system dysfunction. Every long COVID patient I've seen has autonomic nervous system dysfunction. So the overlap is huge.
And Jamie, what are you looking? Oh, go ahead. Yes.
I was just going to say, may I chime in on that? To add to what David was saying, there are, of course, people who have explicit direct lung damage, and that's the cause of their long-term symptoms. However, what we tend to be seeing in these patients who are continuing to experience symptoms over a long period of time and who have these classic neurological symptoms, these are the patients that are ending up meeting the diagnostic criteria, and it is a large number of them. Right. Moreover, that about 50% number is also coming at a very particular snapshot in time for those patients. And the same patients who don't meet the diagnostic criteria today may meet it in 2 or 3 more months, because symptoms don't always come on predictably. I know a patient in particular who did not experience PEM for the first 5 or 6 months of their long-term symptoms, and then they did begin to. So it is at that point that they would begin meeting the diagnostic criteria for ME/CFS.
We're talking about ME/CFS, more commonly known as chronic fatigue syndrome, and long COVID, and the overlap between the two. Our guests are Jamie Seltzer, Director of Scientific and Medical Outreach for ME Action, and Dr. David Kaufman, Internal Medicine Physician at the Center for Complex Diseases. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have chronic fatigue syndrome or long COVID impacted your life? Were you able to get some kind of diagnosis and maybe hopefully some treatment? If so, what questions do you have for our guests? If you work in healthcare, do you have questions about how to spot these things? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about what chronic fatigue syndrome can tell us about long COVID, a chronic fatigue syndrome also known as ME/CFS. Jamie Seltzer is with us, Director and Scientific and Medical Outreach for ME Action. Dr. David Kaufman, also with us, Internal Medicine Physician at the Center for Complex Diseases. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions. What do you want to know? Call 800-642-1234. If you have an experience to share, a question to share, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Dennis joins us now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. What I've experienced is it's a downward spiral. Again, getting sick, get fatigued, try to get back up and get back at it, and fatigue just makes things worse, which leads to more stress. Stress causes more susceptibility to illnesses, and then it just becomes a psychological thing, too, where it's just almost like I wonder, well, geez, is this a habit or something, where it's just my subconscious just doesn't believe I can get up and get better? I'll hang up and listen.
Dennis, sorry for your experience with that. Jamie, have you heard that from other people where you start with this physical condition and, as Dennis says, it adds to this stress spiral and mental and emotional concerns at the same time?
I think in a general way, what I'm actually hearing described is the nature of post-exertional malaise. If you push past your new ability limits, you can make yourself worse. And if you push yourself again before you recover from that previous bout, you'll make yourself worse than that. And this is, it's very common to want to get back to your everyday life and get back to the way that things used to be. But this is a chronic disease. In using one of our older sets of diagnostic criteria, which tends to identify people who are less ill on average, with less severe disease presentation, 5% of people recover who are adults. So it's important to acknowledge limitations that have arisen due to the disease and adapt with the activity management strategy that we call pacing, which is to be active when you're able and rest when you're tired. And sometimes that entails breaking up activities into smaller pieces so that they're more manageable with rest periods in between. I think that that psychological reaction that our caller was describing of feeling as though if you only push hard enough, you'll overcome is very common. We're gaslighting ourselves in a way. This is the type of disease that's like a special knot where the harder you tug at it, the tighter it holds you. It is not something that you can push past with your willpower. And I would also add that this is part of the process of accepting disease and disability. We live in a very ableist culture, and we're certainly taught our whole lives in implicit and explicit ways that the harder we work, the more capable we will become. And we're taught not to acknowledge our limits. This disease changes your limits, and that may be permanent. And accepting that is a process and through which we have to be kind to ourselves. You are not fooling yourself. It's not true that you're not trying hard enough. It's, you have to treat yourself like you would your closest friend or dearest family that we're going through this kind of experience.
Dennis, thanks for that call. Thanks for sharing your experience. Dr. Kaufman, is, as Jamie says, it sounds like powering through is not the solution here. Are there kinds of treatments that can help people, though?
Yeah, so I, of course, totally agree with Jamie and the need for pacing. And we see the problem of trying to push through all the time. But I want to add another piece to this. Do not, at least I think, do not interpret what Jamie just said as that the person, Dennis in this case, should accept their fatigue. They need to make sure or look into, has somebody tried to understand what is driving and causing that fatigue? Meaning that just saying somebody has ME/CFS and that's why you have fatigue, for me, clinically, as a physician, is not enough. Has their blood pressure and heart rate been checked? Have they been examined for POTS? Have they been examined for autoimmune illness? Has anyone done laboratory work looking for chronic reactivated infections? Do they have something called mast cell activation syndrome? And every single thing I just said is treatable. It's diagnosable and treatable. And those are major drivers of the phenotype, the presentation of chronic fatigue syndrome.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Madison. Nancy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Nancy?
Turn our radio down.
Sure.
I don't hear you.
Yep, go ahead, Nancy. You're on the air.
Okay. I had COVID in March. Several months later, I started getting sick with multiple infections that left me with fatigue, several with high fevers. I talked to my doctor about it. I mean, I got at least six different kinds of infections. My doc said she called it post-COVID chronic inflammation and just told me to document it, which I did. But I could tell she had nothing to offer me. So I went to an herbalist kind of person who runs a store, and he told me to start taking, I'm telling you this because it was very helpful, fairly high doses of turmeric, 2 pills 3 times a day.
Nancy, we're limited on time. I don't know if particular herbal remedies have been studied, but Dr. Kaufman, in that situation, that office visit, what would you hope for follow-up as Nancy describes what she described to her doctor?
Well, it's some of what I said a few minutes ago. I would look for what those infections are. It's well known and demonstrated now that COVID leads to reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus, EBV. EBV is a classic virus in our ME/CFS patients as well. So again, the overlap. And that causes or can lead to a disturbance of the immune system, which can then lead to these other infections that Nancy is describing. The turmeric is interesting because this is a situation of chronic uncontrolled inflammation, and curcumin, which is the main ingredient, so to speak, in turmeric, is a potent anti-inflammatory medication. So that makes sense that she would feel better with it. The question is there anything else going on post-COVID leading to her long COVID symptoms?
Thanks a lot for calling in, Nancy, and sharing that with us. Jamie, what are you hoping for as someone who both deals with this yourself and researches it? What would you hope to see in the medical community when it comes to doctors being trained in recognizing and doing some of the diagnoses that Dr. Kaufman does?
I think that's a pretty complex answer. I would say that this is a complicated illness. People like Dr. Kaufman are rare. We're hoping to educate more clinicians. Right now, I'm working with Mayo Clinic Rochester on their diagnostic algorithm and 2 CMEs, which is continuing medical education, in order to help educate more clinicians about the modern understanding of ME/CFS and infection-associated chronic disease in general, of course. I think that recognizing it in the clinic and understanding as a general practitioner what you can do in the clinic, you can do a quick test for some kinds of dysautonomia called the Nasaline directly in your clinic room. You can recognize post-exertional malaise and tell the patient that they need to rest and that they need to pace. And you can help refer them to the right kinds of specialized testing that they may need in order to detect some of the more treatable conditions that Dr. Kaufman was mentioning before, like MCAS and POTS. One of the things that we hear often is that standard blood tests aren't showing enough. And you may see things like lowered vitamin D or lowered B12 with pretty classical testing, but the kinds of immune, endocrine, neurological, metabolic dysregulation that are at the root of this disease are not found on these everyday tests. And so we need clinicians to become familiar with who is ME literate in their area for testing that's more specific to the immune system, to the nervous system, especially the autonomic nervous system and the immune system, so that they know who to refer to.
Thanks to both of our guests today. Jamie Seltzer is a director of scientific and medical outreach for ME Action and a researcher who studies post-exertional malaise with Stanford University. She also lives herself with ME/CFS. And Dr. David Kaufman is an internal medicine physician at the Center for Complex Diseases, which he co-founded. They talked to us about what chronic fatigue syndrome, better known as ME/CFS in the medical community, might tell us about treatment of long COVID. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Before you reach for that bag of sugar when you're baking, think again. Our next guest is a pastry cook who uses fruits and other natural sources of sweetness. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.